Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Hello and welcome back to the final episode of Still Watching Westworld Season 3. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
This week we are talking about the Season 3 finale of Westworld titled Crisis Theory. If you've been listening to us cover the TV show Mrs. America, that episode will be out on Wednesday. We'll be switching over to Mrs. America, the FX on Hulu series for full time for the rest of that season. So your feed will no longer be muddled after this. But this is our wrap up on Westworld season 3. We've got a great interview this week. We spoke to the lovely Tandy Newton, who of course plays Maeve Millay, about, you know, this season and what she hopes for the future for Maeve and all of that. So that will be at the end of this episode. But first, Richard and I are going to sort of break down the season and this episode and how we think Westworld did or didn't stick the landing this season and set up possible future seasons of the show. Really quickly, if you're listening to this episode and you did not stay past the end credits on this finale, you're going to want to go back and watch those, because just like last year, and I think also in the season premiere this year, there were very significant things that happened after the credits rolled on Westworld. So you're going to want to go check.
Like at least one full major plot scene.
If not two. Yeah. So yeah, you're going to want to check those out before you hear us talk about them necessarily. All right. So let's get into it as a whole. Richard, on the whole, how did this season of Westworld work for you?
Well, I think it had its ups and its downs. I think a lot of what it was about, in terms of, you know, kind of deterministic computing models for human behavior, was pretty interesting. I keep referencing the show Devs, which was pretty similar. And if people like that kind of science, you know, theorizing, they could go check out Devs. It is a self-contained miniseries. There will be no more episodes of it, so you can know that when you get to the end, it's the end, which is not the end for Westworld. And I'm very curious about where they go from here. I think this season, hopefully, I can view as a bridge season to something that's a little bit, I think, better realized than I think this season ultimately achieved. But, you know, I'm glad that Dolores saw a plastic bag blowing in the wind and decided the world was beautiful.
There's something that, you know, Tandy Newton said in the interview, and I don't want to spoil it, the interview too much, but she was talking about how, like, Maeve wasn't really activated fully, that she starts the season kind of purposeless because she sort of achieved her goal at the end of season 2, and she's not really activated until the final episode. And I kind of agree with that. Like, it didn't really feel like Maeve was really Maeve until the very end of this episode. And then when she was, like, oh, you know, in those moments at the end when it's just Maeve and Caleb, I was so excited to see a Maeve that I better recognized. just the way, and by extension, just because I find Maeve so compelling, like, I was even more like interested in what Caleb might do next because Maeve was interested in him. Does that make sense? Like by yeah. proxy of her attention to him, I was paying more attention to him. So
I think that Maeve's realizations and allegiances do a lot to point the viewer toward what to care about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard with Dolores because she's so kind of monomaniacal about her thing, which I guess we got some kind of nuance about this episode. But yeah, Maeve, I think, in a confusing season, in her confusion, has been kind of our audience surrogate. And it was really nice to kind of see her return to the Westworld that Maeve that we know, as a kind of check for us in the audience as well.
Yeah, exactly. All right. I want to hit, a few emails that we have, before we get into sort of the details of the episode. We got this one email from a big element of this finale is this riot that's happening in downtown LA, right? And you see a lot of imagery that, at least to me, is pretty familiar from having watched like some of the things that happened in Ferguson or elsewhere, over the last few years, in terms of protests, like through my phone, like through Twitter or, you know, Instagram video or whatever it was. There's just some imagery of like people tossing Molotov cocktails or tear gas canisters, stuff like that, that looked very familiar to me. And so I thought this email was interesting. It comes from Chris, who writes in, the finale from an activist's point of view. I'm Chris Chapman, and I'm an activist with the Rise and Resist and Gays Against Guns here in New York City. I've been in the resistance since the 2016 election, but long before that, I've been fighting for reform, whether it be with ACT UP against AIDS, or far too many other battles to name. The finale of Westworld sent chills up and down every part of my soul, truly. To have a world that you know, love, and exist in every day become torn down by your own hands is terrifying. But sometimes that world does indeed need to be reborn. So to watch the chaos that ensued after Rehoboam and Insight's control over humanity was revealed, and to watch Dolores and Maeve struggle while Caleb and Serac stand by as witnesses, those scenes are going to have my mind churning for a long time to come. As an activist, some see me as a destroyer just like Dolores, that I want to tear this world down and start again, bring justice and equality to all. I found something in my heart tonight that I knew was always there. Dolores' last words brought it all home for me. The years of struggle and frustration against the system of politics and greed that at every turn seems determined to end the world when I'm equally determined to save it. It all makes more sense now that I find graceful reason with a character that is an artificial intelligence. So as Dolores poignantly said, the memories I held on to until the end weren't the ugly ones. I remember the moments where I saw what they were really capable of, moments of kindness here and there. They created us. They knew enough of beauty to teach it to us. Maybe they can fight it themselves again. There's ugliness in the world. It's array. I choose to see the beauty, and so do I. So this is Chris's perspective, and like I take your American Beauty acknowledgement, Richard, but I think it's interesting for someone who has more experience than I do as an activist to maybe see this view of all this violence, all this mayhem from an understandably enraged populace, and zero in on, you know, the calm and determined and placid artificial intelligence at the center of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that, like, I think as erratic and kind of messy as I found the finale, I think that it did, at the very least, zero in on, as this email kind of gets at, like, an important philosophical read of the kind of chaos of humanity right now, you know, mm-hmm. in that there is, at root, of a struggle, a kind of hope and optimism in what people can be and what, like, people organized in a civilization can be. And I guess if, as a kind of statement of future sort of political intent, I'm curious to see, where this episode leads us, with a Westworld season 4, whenever that may happen.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. The thing that actually worked the best for me in this episode, two things. One, I have been asking all season for Jeffrey Wright to have something more to do other than sort of, it seems like, stumble along behind Dolores on her path. I mean, this is the thing, is like Dolores had a real purpose this season. And to a certain degree, Hale had a real purpose this season, eventually a very clear purpose. But Bernard and Maeve, you know, despite being characters we love and are interested in and are, you know, definitely people you want to keep centered on a show like this, I feel like Westworld didn't really know what to do with them this season. So they were a bit like wheel spinning, in some degree, you know, until the very end. And so like, I was so grateful. It felt like it kind of came out of nowhere. I don't feel like it was really seeded that well this season. But they did finally give Jeffrey Wright some actual acting to do, you know what I mean? Which is something I had been begging for, in his scene against, Gina Torres talking about Arnold's son and stuff like that. And it did feel like, I mean, we can talk about the post, credits ending of the episode, but, it did feel like he finally now at the end is filled with some kind of purpose that is centered on himself and not some sort of vague, like, I need to stop her or I need to save humanity for what I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think this season was, you know, a necessary transition one, and that this was the remaining host out in the real world, and there would be some adjustment to be done on their part to figure out where they belonged in something that is, or you know, increasingly unordered, you know, as opposed to their life in the park. And so, yeah, it did make some sense that in this episode, at least, like, they guided Bernard / Arnold toward a certain kind of raison d'etre, you know, much in the way that Maeve arrived at, and Caleb, you know, even though he's the human in the mix. But, so I find it hard to, I guess, fault the series for, like, something that was maybe intentional in that it was about these beings like fumbling towards meaning. It didn't always make the most satisfying viewing, but I'm glad that at least at the end, they kind of, you know, rounded things out, I guess.
I'm curious if you think this, you know, so you had said a couple weeks ago, like, I bet Dolores dies at the end of the season. And then you were like, and then we heard about the renewal. Which Tandy Newton told me, like, she found out sort of along with everyone else. So, like, they didn't know necessarily in advance. So I almost wonder if that post-credit stuff, well, it couldn't have been filmed later. I don't know what to tell you. Maybe they filmed it just in case they got a renewal, and that's why it's post-credits, all the stuff after that or whatever. Because the ending with Maeve and Caleb and This is the New World, you can be whatever the fuck you want, like, it could have been a series finale,
yeah,
moment,
definitely.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, according to Tandy Newton, like, they weren't sure they were getting a season four renewal. So, so this could have been the end of Dolores. Like, you could read this as the end of Dolores, or at least Dolores Prime. But do you imagine a world in which Westworld goes forward without Evan Rachel Wood on the show?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's tricky because this episode really gave her the kind of Jesus dying for our sins kind of thing, you know?
Right.
You know, her motivation, it turned out all along, was to save humanity, not to end it. And there was a necessary amount of sacrifice contained within that mission. Yeah. And that now feels very complete. So I don't know how you kind of are like, well, actually she has something else to do. But, you know, at least one of the world's major religions is waiting on Jesus's return. So I guess, you know, we have that kind of, we have a return narrative built into our sort of social, you know, ideology. So why can't Westworld do it? I just hope that it's not, it doesn't feel kind of like the rest of the story continues. And also Dolores, you know, I hope that they find an organic way to include her again, if they're going to indeed include her.
I mean, there's a million ways to bring, you know, there's other Dolores Pearls out there. There's, you know, there's digital Dolores, you know, they found a bunch of different ways to bring characters back this season. So there's a million different ways she could come back. And it is interesting to me how death does and doesn't work in Westworld and what feels permanent, what doesn't. Like, let's say Dolores saying goodbye to Teddy in season two, I felt so sure was the end of James Marsden. I felt so sure he wasn't coming back for season three, and he didn't come back for season three. But like, could he come back from season four? Absolutely. Charlotte Hale has all those printers working. Like, James Marsden could absolutely be back for season four. Anyone could. Literally anyone could, because of the host possibilities. And in one storytelling perspective, that's exciting, because we could see like all of our, you know, I was joking to a friend last night. I was like, what if it's all Logan's on the printers? What if it's all Ben Barnes and we just get like an army of Ben Barnes? That would be okay. So yeah.
We haven't signed our writing contracts yet, Joanna, for season four. So let's not spill the beans. Before it's too early, you know, too early. I mean, I think that is something that, like, that the Charlotte Hale version of Dolores storyline in this episode makes exciting when thinking about the future of Westworld, is that we're going to return to a sort of narrative where we can be surprised that someone's a host, you know, because we're not going to know.
Right.
And I think that was in some ways. That kind of, yes, it was maybe relied on a little too heavily in the first couple seasons, but like in the first two seasons, but I think in the third, I did sort of miss the mystery of not knowing who was a host and who wasn't. And I think that they found a smart way to kind of reintroduce that, in upcoming episodes.
Yeah. Literally anyone could come back. Literally anyone could be a host. They could get Anthony Hopkins back if they wanted to, you know what I mean? Like the sky's the limits now that, Charlotte has all those printers and like no scruples as to what to do with them. So, you know, here we go. So let's see. Yeah. I mean, you know, like, because when an episode starts with a voiceover, you know, you and I just watched Sunset Boulevard for Little Gold Men, but when an episode starts with a voiceover, like, I've died many times, but there is only one real end. I will write this one myself, from Dolores. There's an audience impulse in me where I really want this to be an end for that Dolores. Otherwise, this ending doesn't mean so much to me as an audience member. That might not be true for everyone. And so Dolores Prime, who had her memories wiped, I would prefer she not come back. And it's not because I don't like the character.
It has to mean something.
Yeah.
There has to be consequence to her. Yeah.
But anyone could show up wearing Evan Rachel Wood's face, and that might be a fun acting challenge for Evan Rachel Wood, and that might be fun. Do you know what I mean? But like, this Dolores, it feels like it needs to be over for her, right?
Do you think there's a... Oh, I think absolutely, and I think the show would be a bit wayward if they didn't honor that, you know? You know, it's their own invention, and I hope they don't undermine their own work, you know?
Something that we did get in this episode is we now know what all the parks are called, or what function they serve, right? There were some mysteries left over. Tandy referred to the medieval world that we don't know what it's called yet as Dragon World when I was talking to her. So that's what I'm going to call it until proven otherwise, since Tandy Newton said it. I get to say it. Dragon World is Park 4. But we found out what the mysterious Park 5 was. So if you go to the Delos Destinations website, it has like little images up and descriptions of the various parks. And Park 5 has always been this like weird, blank, white, closed to visitors mystery. And now that tile that was just like sort of closed to visitors or whatever, underneath it says defense contracts only or something like that. So like now we know what Park 5 was, which is like, there's War World, but there's also like training world, war training world, which is where we see, I mentioned this last week, that there was this weird flash in Caleb's memory of him, like, shooting someone in, like, what looked like a 4th of July parade almost. This, like, classic Americana setting. And it turns out that was from the Park 5. And that's where he, you know, he first met, actually, Dolores, was in that park. So, Richard, what are the creepy implications of there being a park in Westworld where, our military or any military maybe, can train their soldiers?
I mean, I guess better to train with hosts than real people. I mean, honestly, I think in our real world, with like, private military contractors and all that shit, I think we're creepier than this imagined thing. But it does, I think that it is an interesting expansion of the kind of Delos corporate mission, you know? Like, it's been clear since at least season one that, like, the park in its entertainment purpose was really not the point. It was kind of the front-facing, marketable thing. Like, oh, this company made robots that we can, like, kill and have sex with. Yay. But actually they are gathering information, but also it told him that as a kind of another ancillary, like, profit arm, they would be, you know, leasing out to the military or whatever. It makes sense. And I think that, like, the more that the corporate strategy of a company like that makes sense, like, the richer the kind of the world of the show becomes.
Absolutely. I agree. And it satisfies me. I didn't think she had, but it really satisfies me to know that Dolores didn't pick him, didn't stumble upon Caleb randomly. That was a question I had all season, was like, how much of these seeming plot inconsistencies are actual inconsistencies, and how much of them are Dolores' master plan? And her meeting Caleb at least feels comfortably like a master plan, thing. Though I will say, and I had this exchange with a couple people, so I feel like I'm not alone in this, the idea that, like, Caleb didn't rape her is, like, that's putting the bar on the ground for, like, human decency, right? Like,
I knew you were good because you didn't. Yeah. I mean, I guess that, like, but at the same time, Dolores' view of things is like, but all everyone rapes. I mean, that's why everyone goes to the park. So the one person who doesn't, she's like, yeah, okay. You know, I think it's less the show's moral bar is being low, and more hers, because she has not been shown much better.
Okay. I can buy. You've satisfied me with that. Is there a question that was answered for you in this episode that felt the most satisfying? Any questions you had hanging around the season?
I mean, I think that, I guess that, like, I, you know, part of me thinks that the way that they sort of flushed out Dolores's motivations felt like a bit of a kind of cheat in a way, like, oh no, she really was, like, invested in the beauty of things all along. And yet I also found it kind of satisfying, that she wasn't the kind of, I guess, destructive villain she could have been. I don't want to compare it to something else, I guess, but, like, I'm glad in a way that she wasn't Daenerys, you know?
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
And I don't know that I love the way that she wasn't that, but I'm glad at least that she wasn't.
See, like, I don't mind the way there's a lot I don't mind about the way in which she wasn't. What I do mind is, like, or what I don't understand is why she wouldn't tell Bernard or Maeve throughout the season sort of what her plan was. Like, keeping Caleb in the dark so he could make, like, a humanistic free will choice, I can kind of buy, but not letting Maeve and Bernard in and letting them think that she is, you know, still on her agenda of season two, which is, you know, kill all men sort of thing. That to me seems like, once again, Westworld doing a thing where preserving the surprise felt more interesting to them than, like, you know, a plot line that made full sense, if that makes any sense. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was frustrating for me to watch Bernard and Maeve. They were forced into a position of being a little slower on the uptake than I normally think of them as. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, they were making these assumptions about Dolores, but they're so smart. So it's frustrating to watch them be wrong all season just so that we could all be, you know, quote unquote, surprised by, you know, a turnabout from Dolores, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not clear to me how thought through this season was from the get-go. You know, I think there was a lot of like stuff that was obfuscated, maybe not out of like a deep knowing of what was being obfuscated, but kind of a killing, you know, sort of like killing time until they figured it out in a way, you know. And yeah. I think that that's something that I was a little frustrated with this finale, was that like there's a lot of kind of there, it's not like a info dump exactly, it's a sort of motivation dump. It's like, oh, okay, this is what everyone's been doing this whole season. Maybe that could have been built a little bit more seamlessly into the spine of the season, rather than it having it be so erratic that like everything we've been watching Maeve and Bernard do all season now is sort of like moot. That's a little frustrating. And I think that like, you know, I kept thinking about what this was like for the actors and if they were happy, which is why I'm excited to listen to your interview with Tandy. You know, because they all got good moments, but I wonder kind of what the sort of holistic view of the season is from their perspective. Because from a viewer perspective, I think it had a lot of good ideas, but it took them a while to arrive at those ideas.
We discussed that interview that Ed Harris gave Vulture, right, about his feelings on this season.
Yeah, that he was a bit like, it wasn't fun to do it because I didn't know what I was doing.
Well, he was like, I got hired to play the Man in Black, and I'm not get hired to play the Man in White, and I don't really, you know, like this, all this sort of stuff. And I think a lot of people took that as like, Ed Harris doesn't like Westworld anymore, but I kind of took it as like, Ed Harris wants to play the character he felt like he was playing at the beginning. So I was kind of happy for him at the very end to see, you know, so like, William's dead now. I mean, for whatever death is worth. In Westworld, William the Human is dead now, and Ed Harris will get, in theory, if season four picks up in the same place, will get to play this sort of robotic Man in Black, or not robotic, but like hardcore villainous, which it seems is what Ed Harris liked to do most on Westworld. And so I was kind of like, oh, Ed gets to do what he wants. And like, if Tandy likes to play Maeve, like activated and, you know, purposeful and all that sort of stuff like that, that's what she gets to do in season. It, like, oddly, I got kind of excited for a season four. I don't know if this is like deluded of me or whatever, but you know what I mean?
Well, I think that, like, you know, in a way that that Dolores set off an EMP last week, I think the show kind of did that at the end of this episode, where they were like, okay, everything about season three that you didn't like is like now kind of gone. We've reset in a way. You know, I think that's part of what, like, Maeve saying to Caleb about like, you can be whatever you want. Like, the show is in fact giving itself permission to like shake this season off in a way. But I think an interesting behind the scenes detail is that Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan read that interview with Harris, and then that post credit scene was all filmed on Zoom, which is really impressive. That, you know, I think Amy Madigan was behind the camera with Ed and whatever the stunt double was playing the other Ed. I just think it's amazing what people can do now.
Richard, I very rarely fall for your like dry delivery, but I genuinely fell for it this time because we live in such uncertain corona times that like my jaw dropped, and then like 2 seconds later, my thoughts were like, wait a minute.
No, it wasn't Zoom. It was FaceTime.
I feel so dumb. Okay. I didn't have to admit that I fell for that, but I just thought I'd be honest with you guys over here in podcast land and tell you that Richard got me for half a second. Okay. So, the post-credit sequence, let's talk about that. So William's journey in this episode is he escapes from Bernard after Bernard like bitch slaps him a couple times, which is really enjoyable for me to watch. And then we get a shot of him like sort of spattered in blood, and he's got this weird blood pattern on his face. And, we don't really know how he got all that blood over him, but like presumably he just like killed his way indoors. And he's talking to his accountant about getting, freeing up his money, and he's drinking expensive whiskey, right? And then the next time we see him, he's in Dubai in this post-credit sequence at like Dulles International, and he finds Charlotte in the basement printing hosts, and she's print a copy of himself. When I first watched that post-credits, I thought that that must have been like a little bit of a time jump, since like the revolution seemed to have calmed down in Dubai. Or maybe there never was a revolution in Dubai. I don't know. But he has that same weird blood pattern on his face in that post-credits, sequence. So that he did in the whiskey drinking scene. So, not much time would have elapsed at all between, where we saw him in the middle of the episode and where we saw him in the post-credits. So that's interesting, information. Does everything that happened in the post-credits with William at least feel clear to you?
Yeah, except I don't necessarily know what the efficacy of having a host William is, you know? Why does it need to look like him? You know, because clearly his standing within the kind of people world has been greatly reduced, if not completely eliminated, in that he has to break into his own company or his former company, you know? So I'm not really sure what the Charlotte strategy is for having a kind of pretend William. More than it is just kind of like cool to see him back in the outfit. But you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, honestly, after talking to Tessa Thompson, who said that, at the end of season two, you know, at the very end of season two, Bernard/Arnold wakes up and Dolores is there, but also someone else is there played by Tessa Thompson. We find out later in this season that that is also Dolores. But we didn't know that at the end of season two, and more instrumentally, Tessa Thompson didn't know that at the end of season two. So I think there is plenty that they just don't know, and they're very comfortable with that. Like Tessa Thompson was basically asked to play that character at the end of season two as blank as possible so that that person could be whoever it needed to be in season three. So what is Charlotte's plan with the Man in Black? I'm not sure they even know yet. The writers, you know what I mean? They just like are like, won't it be fun to have William back as the Man in Black? What we do know is that in the post credit, you know, and this will lead us into the second post credit scene, but what we do know is that in the post credit scene at the end of season two, according to their plan at the time, that was a massive time jump in the future. And that version, so there's two possibilities for what it can look like for a synthetic creature played by Ed Harris. There's like a host human hybrid sort of thing, which is what like Jeffrey Wright has been playing all season. And then there's like the attempt to put a human consciousness in a host body. And that's what, Peter Mullen, Jim Delos was doing last season, right? So those are, it's a slight difference, but those are two different things. Host human hybrid versus host consciousness in a robot body. So the William, I know this is like a little weedy, but the William that we met at the end of season two, that was sort of a Jim Delos thing. That was like human consciousness in a robot body, fidelity, all that sort of stuff. The idea was that a lot of time had elapsed as they were trying to get that version of William to be, you know, for his human consciousness to not glitch out in the robot body, right? And so I think that that thing we saw at the end of season two is different from what it is Charlotte has built here, which seems like more of a, like what Bernard is, which is she built it from her memory of, you know, she talks about how she built it from like her memory. And so she built it from her memory, Dolores's memory of who the Man in Black was in the park. So I don't even think it's like got any of that Jimmy Simpson. You know, if you take the various Williams as those figures that we met in that group therapy session earlier this season, and there's Jimmy Simpson, and there's Tuxedo William, and there's Man in Black William, and there's Little Boy William, stuff like that. I think this thing that Charlotte has built is just Man in Black William. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's where we are. But in terms of like a lot of time elapsing and connecting to that season two post credits, that's sort of what the Bernard post credits feels like. Do I know why Stubbs, like no one bothered to check on that motel room where Bernard and Stubbs were for seemingly decades? No, I do not. But there was a riot happening elsewhere in California. So maybe like the motel just shut down and they were left to their own devices in that motel room, right? But presumably Stubbs is like turned to robotic goo in the bathtub, because ice doesn't last for decades, right? But Bernard is sitting there waiting to be reactivated in a way, which I don't know if that means Jeffrey Wright won't be in season four or if we'll go directly to the time jump in season four or what we'll do. But that's my impression of what happened in the other post-credits sequence. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it does. I think that like the how much time has elapsed is an interesting thing to kind of unpack and figure out. And you know what exactly he was doing there. So in the other place. But you know, again, this also felt like a reset for him. You know, we can get him really back in the game in the next season. Which, you know, who knows when that's going to be at this point.
Absolutely. Exactly. Like 2022 at the earliest, right? Because yeah. It takes a long time, no matter what, to shoot a season of Westworld, and everything is delayed right now. So who knows what that's going to happen. Is there anything else you want to get into in this episode?
I mean, you know, goodbye, Vincent Cassell.
Maybe. We didn't see him die, so.
That's true. I mean, I thought he was, you know, he was an effective, I think he sold a kind of confusing character in a way. I think he sold it well. And, you know, I kind of did like that, like, in the end, even he was ultimately trying to do the right thing. You know, it was a very bad way to do the right thing. But like, I like that he wasn't like a, you know, wahaha, like, you know, evil kind of doer who was hell bent on enslaving humanity. I think, you know, there was pathos there, and I think that Cassell did a good job. I would assume he's done, but maybe not.
He might be. I love, like, Vincent Cassell was, I think, the high point for me this season. I don't think the season works at all for me if he's not there. And I loved, you know, Tandy talked about how, like, working with Vincent Cassell was, like, a lifelong dream of hers, and I, like, don't blame her because, like, what a fun scene partner to have. And if you haven't watched the behind-the-scenes interview that they did for this finale, please do. You know, you can find it on wherever you get your HBO. Because Vincent Cassell, at one point, he's talking about Rehoboam and Serac and their sort of symbiotic relationship, and he talks about it as if it were, like, Dr. Frankenstein and the monster, except he pronounced Frankenstein like Frankenstein, like both the Mel Brooks movie, but just like really the real German pronunciation. He like went real German on it. It wasn't even French. It was fantastic. So please enjoy that as like a little after dinner mint of this Westworld finale, is Vincent Cassell pronouncing Frankenstein that way. Yeah, I loved him in the season, and I hope they bring him back, even if just like, you know, for a Peter Mullen-esque cameo, like we got this season. I would love to have him, because you know. All right, I think we did it. Westworld really, I have to hand it to them for all my frustrations this season, that they got me excited for season four. But yeah, this does feel like this season, I think when we look back at the arc of Westworld, whether or not it gets four seasons, five seasons, six seasons, I think this will feel like a place setting season when we think back on it. You know, like this season really set up the transition to the real world and whatever it is that our characters are going to do next. And season four might be like a slam dunk, great, all time great season now that a lot of our characters are sort of back in an active position. It's just a shame that a lot of them were in passive positions this season, you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's weird. I didn't expect to feel excited for season four and yet
and here we are.
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess I don't want to wrap up without mentioning this last two things, because I feel like I'm gonna get emails about it if we don't. Obviously the ending feels like an homage to Fight Club. Not just like Maeve and Caleb standing watching skyscrapers blow up, but also the like earlier in the episode when people call Dolores sir and Caleb sir, that felt very Fight Club to me as well. So you know, they stopped short of using the Pixies over the closing. They used Pink Floyd instead, but that Pixie song that famously plays at the end of Fight Club was used both in The Leftovers when Carrie Coon and Justin Theroux's characters were like watching nukes go off in Australia, and in the episode of Mr. Robot, and Mr. Robot obviously takes a lot from Fight Club. So I feel like that Pixie song is like banned from prestige television for a while. Otherwise, I feel like Ramin Djawadi would have done a beautiful like piano cover of "Where Is My Mind" from the end of Fight Club right there. How useful, Richard, is it for like there to be such a direct film homage outside of an episode called genre?
I mean, you know, I thought it was cute. And I think that this show has always had at its best, like a kind of winking sense of humor that was maybe a little bit lost this season minus some May stuff. So it was nice to like end, on a note of like, yeah, a sense of grandeur, but also like, you know, we can be kind of sly and referencey too.
Perfect. And then the last thing I want to point out is like, you and I had talked about the poster when you were talking about Dolores maybe dying at the end of the season, and I mentioned that like that robotic body had some scraps of blue fabric on it, so it was definitely Dolores. But if folks want to pull up the season 3 poster as they're listening to this and look at it again, you'll notice that the skyline in the background is definitely Dubai, because you can see the Burj Khalifa sort of like at the center of it. And then there's just like sand everywhere, which could either be Dubai or it could be like, you could think of it as like the dust on Bernard. And then the tagline of the season is "Free will is not free." And so there's so much of the closing minutes of this episode just on that poster. And that's the kind of like really sly, winky, fun shit that Westworld likes to do. So, you know, they had their fun with us, with that poster. So. All right, let us go to our conversation with Tandy Newton to talk about Maeve and some of the themes she loves about Westworld. So let's hear from the great Tandy Newton.
I was reading another interview you gave at the beginning of the season where you're talking about Maeve has no purpose in a way because she accomplished what she wanted at the end of season 2. And so this season is sort of about finding a reason for Maeve to sort of give a shit about what's going on in the real world. And so for you as a performer to start a season of television somewhat purposeless, like, you know, when so much of acting is about like, what's my motivation? What challenges does that present for you as a performer?
What was happening in the first season is that Maeve keeps turning herself on in different situations and then turning herself off. I mean, literally, she was able to do that. And then in season 3, she is being switched on when she doesn't want to be,
right. You
know. So it's that. I mean, I loved her agency in season 1. I loved her, how uncompromising she was. She didn't even put herself in a place where she could be compromised. And it's been, I don't know, it's been strangely frustrating, certainly for the character. Well, I guess for me too, in a way, but all with a purpose, because at the point when Maeve is presented with a choice, she has to make it. And that obviously that doesn't happen till the end of season 3. I mean, I certainly don't think that she thinks she's ever going to have to. Her arm is being twisted by Serac. Maeve is like, she misleads us all, accidentally in the way that she assumes that Dolores has a vendetta against humanity and is going to see that through. And so she's, and Serac helps her, helps Maeve to helps confirm that, because he also thinks that Dolores is out to attack right. humanity. So the frustration that I mentioned about Maeve just, oh, you know, here I am again, this guy trying to get me to do this thing. You know, it makes sense because she only wants to save humanity insofar as it's not going to get rid of the virtual world where her loved ones are. So in a way, Maeve's agency starts again in episode 8 of season right. 3.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I've spent basically pretty much 2 and 3 floundering, you know, learning some katana skills and having an extraordinary experience. And also, you know, creating a path for the audience to better understand what, you know, what the hosts have been dealing with. You know, she's obviously been aware of the enormity of, you know, this whole Westworld, franchise, you know, War World, Shogun World. Now there's Dragon World, you know, but her agency begins again at the end of season 3. So I'm, you know, obviously I like her being, I want her to help. I want her to help the world. I want her to be I want her to be part of the solution and not the problem. Of course, she's not a baddie. And I really love that about her. It had a huge influence on, certainly on my life. And yeah, but that's just a personal preference. Wherever they take this, I really trust these guys. I think they're master storytellers, and I love being around them. I really love the work environment that they create. It's bloody hard work, and can be frustrating. But it's, you know, everybody is putting more than they think they could ever manage into this show. It really calls on people to be innovative and to do better than their best. And that's a great environment.
Yeah.
You know? But I have absolutely no idea what the hell could happen now. I mean, really, I'm absolutely baffled. I didn't think, I mean, with season 2, I had no idea. 3, same thing, like what? So it's really, and I'm not a sci-fi person, you know, I very much bound to the earth. so yeah, baffled. But thankfully there's a little time before we all have to do that again.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You know, you have so many obviously incredible fight scenes this season, and I do want to talk to you about them. But my favorite, my 2 favorite scenes of yours are the 2 long conversations you share with Dolores with Evan Rachel Wood. And
oh yeah.
Do you think that there is a significance to the fact that, like, you know, it's frustrating for us to watch Dolores and Maeve at cross purposes all season? Because we're like, I think you would agree if you just talk to each other. But do you think there's a significance to the fact that they are able to sort of connect and talk and understand each other in virtual spaces? That's where they're able to talk to each other, communicate. And then whenever they meet in the real world, it's a fight. And so I was wondering if there was some sort of significance to the fact that, like, they can communicate when they are in a virtual space, but cannot do it very effectively in the real world. Do you know what I mean? Maybe I'm overcooking.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're overcooking. Although I think, interestingly, one of those conversations that you mentioned had Dolores destroy Hector.
Right.
During the conversation. So that was the most brutal fight scene in many ways, mm-hmm. except Maeve wasn't even fighting. Right. You know, it's always, you know, in that scene, it's a conversation, but then it ends up being something that provokes Maeve. It's almost like Dolores is provoking Maeve. I feel like Dolores is much more, binary, like there's good and bad with her, you know? And I feel like Maeve sees the shades in everybody. And I always felt that Dolores was kind of, in terms of recognizing the subtleties and the shades of how human beings are. And I think that was largely to do with her relationship with Lutz and Sylvester. You know, she really came to sort of learn about people through her interaction with those two. I feel that Maeve was already at the point where she, well, certainly was, where humanity was neither good nor bad, you know. And, but Dolores changed her mind. That's something really, really important. All of season two, she wanted to destroy humanity. It was very clear. And then she changed her mind. So, it took a minute for Maeve to catch up, because in that first conversation that she has with Dolores, it's the original Dolores that they've kind of remade in this virtual world, in the Serac world, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the Dolores that's out in the human world fighting.
Right.
That she's like weeks older. Because you can see what's so interesting is how different the different Doloreses are based on the time they spend as the new character. Like, she, you know, Hale, within days, she was attached to her human family.
Right.
You know, and so the original Dolores is, you know, and it's great. I love all the stuff with Hale, who was Dolores to begin with, and then has broken away, has just grown. It's like they grow out of her really quick.
So,
she's kind of like the mother with these errant children everywhere. She's just spawning this population. And she even says to Maeve at the end, you were all copies of me. I mean, no wonder Maeve just like, give me a sherry and get me the fuck out of here, man. This is like, you're just making up shit as you go along. You know? Maeve is done. I mean... I think season four might be like, it's like the season where the whole show has to convince Maeve that it's worth, you know, sticking around for. You know what I mean? I feel like that would be a good guide for the next season.
So you mentioned the Hale plot line and also this idea of motherhood and parenthood, which seems so baked into the show at this point.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, how much do you think that has to do with the fact that, you know, this is a big budget, prestige sci-fi, HBO series, you know, co-show run by a woman, Lisa Joy. And then, you know, this season, I feel like Denise Tay has sort of stepped up to have even more involvement. I've heard her talk a lot about the themes of motherhood and how they interest her. So I don't know, like, it's often viewed as a feminine concern, and I think it's interesting to have those themes given the same amount of weight as some of the other things that we've explored in sci-fi in the past. Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know, though, you know. I feel like, I think it's maybe a little short-sighted to just see it as a preoccupation of the female characters, because you've got Ed Harris, who is utterly driven mad by the betrayal of his daughter.
Right.
I mean, utterly. Mm-hmm. And you've got Jeffrey Wright's character, who is undone whenever he has to consider the child that he lost. And then you've also got, Caleb, the stuff with his mum and the fact that she just couldn't handle life and fell apart, and his love for his friend, which is, you know, very a deep bond. I think all the characters, all of them, mm-hmm. the significant characters are preoccupied with their roles as either nurturers or how they failed at that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's just a preoccupation of the women. I really don't. I think it's about responsibility. I think it's about responsibility.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really do. Yeah. I think it's something that is it's making us think about how our actions have affected others. And, you know, in the kind of the torture of time, different time, what's it called? Different timelines. You know, people are really driven mad by the things that they've either done or haven't done. And there's a purpose to that, because I think it's trying to show us the cyclical nature of our negative behavior if we don't deal with trauma, you know?
Yeah.
Or if we go to sleep on the job, which is basically what we're doing, you know, and just not having a conscience, not taking responsibility, not recognizing our agency and the possibilities for freedom and what we could be doing with that. It's like we've all gone to sleep and it's just waking us up, you know, forcing us to consider these different interactions with people that we've had in our lives, and how they become drives, definitely. Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, also, you know, there's Dolores who is childless in the show, a woman who is childless, but the relationships that she has with herself, basically.
Right.
Where that is fascinating to me, just on its own.
Yeah.
It's like she's having to, yeah, I'm just trying to think, help me out. I'm trying to think of the word. It's like she's having to reconcile aspects of herself.
Yeah.
Through copies of herself, you know. And I just, that's so much of I guess what we do as an adult. You know, you look back at different stages of your life and, you know, you kind of try and reason with different aspects of yourself. Certainly in a therapy situation, let's face it, you know, those who've been had the benefit of therapy, very often you are talking to your child or talk, you know, your inner child and all of this. So I think, yeah, that whole kind of decoding consciousness and just recognizing how much what we do is influenced by those outside of us. And, you know, yeah, obviously the whole notion of free will isn't free. But yeah, I think specifically around relationships, the like you were saying about Big Little Lies. Yeah. The themes are very much, around responsibility and caretaking. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always so much to talk about with Westworld.
Did you find out along with everyone else that Westworld had been picked up?
Like a week before.
Mm-hmm. That's a wrinkle I hadn't thought about. There is this question, something I love about Westworld is because bodies can be printed and brains can be swapped and all sort of stuff happens, you have an opportunity to see a favorite character that you thought might be gone, like Simon Quartermain coming back this season when you think he might be gone, something like that. But how does... knowing that death is not always the permanent thing on Westworld, that it can be on other shows, how do you as a performer decide when a death feels final and when it doesn't? Like the Hector death and Maeve's reaction to it felt so final for her this season, even though we've seen Hector die so many times. So can you talk about, you know, death in Westworld and how you reconcile those realities?
Yeah. I mean, death in the show, one thing that you realize is that with the robots in Westworld, they never knew they were dying again and again.
Right.
Because they would be just wiped and then they go back into the park and do the same thing all over again, getting killed in a different way or whatever. Obviously for Maeve, she becomes conscious of the fact that she's dying often.
Right.
So, I think that she sees that there's a utility in death for her, obviously. But you got to play it for real each time. I mean, I think also Maeve is very sympathetic. She's compassionate. So when she sees hosts die, she feels for them every time. So it's not that it doesn't make her less, it doesn't make death less meaningful. So, for example, yeah, when Hector dies, I don't know, we'll have to see. I mean, if Simon coming back was really huge, and it was a really good Simon Quarterman, who plays Lee Sizemore, that was a really good sort of twist, because we thought he was a dead human, and then we assume he is a live human. And then when you find out that actually he's a simulation, it's just really cool. It really works well. So it's using that kind of, yes, characters do come back, but they've always been coming back in a really interesting way. It's not like, oh God, Westworld. It's not lazy. It's not like, Westworld can just, Westworld can just bring people back. So they just do it willy nilly. It's not like, do you remember, I'll never forget this, Dallas, when Bobby Ewing came back.
Yes.
I don't know how many seasons they decided to make a dream, just to get Bobby back. I don't feel like that's ever going to be anything that Westworld will do, with all due respects to bloody Dallas 9, because that was gold for me. no matter how popular a character is, and I think this is something that other shows have done well, I mean, there is a real value to being the kind of show that is confident enough to, you know, to say goodbye to a character and never to see them again, no matter how much your audience kicks and screams and wants to see them, you know. But I can't imagine how Maeve could ever die. I can't see it happening. Like how on earth could you ever believe it? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if that's like some fantastic insurance that I'll always be part of the show. I don't know, because they have the ability to surprise these guys. They really do.
So is it, I mean, I don't expect you to give any major secrets away. It's not definitely why I'm talking to you, but I am curious then, does that ending for Dolores feel so final? It's a huge sacrifice. She gets wiped. It feels done. Do you feel like this is the end for this version of Dolores?
It certainly seems to be. I haven't had that confirmed, but just me as an audience, and the way it felt at the time, and Serac, who, you know, is the capability of his setup is very strong. So if he wipes her memories, and he has no interest in any of the hosts and Delos, you know, he just wants the intellectual property that came from, the information that came from the guests that were at the park. So all those numbers add up to Dolores, as we know her, being gone. But of course she has populated the world with versions of herself. So, you know, maybe there's a version that's in a little cupboard somewhere that's still the old Dolores. But I don't know where that could possibly come from. And whatever happens, it's going to be done in a way which is really surprising and really cool. I mean, you know, it's like, I do understand why people want to know stuff, but I feel like it gets to a point where you just throw your arms up and just accept entertainment. It's like, okay, this isn't a math problem. This isn't for me to solve. This is for me to just sit back and be taken on a journey. You know, it's like trying to stop a roller coaster. It's like trying to put brakes on a roller coaster. It's like, are you going to put all your effort into trying to put brakes on this roller coaster? Or, you know, it's like with anything, it's less painful if you just surrender, you know? That's how I feel about it. Maybe it's just laziness. Also, I really like people showing me how dope they can be. You know, I love Westworld, you know, all the showrunners just, I just get to sit back and freaking, well, actually that's not true. I'm in it, but you know what I mean? Certainly in the scenes that I'm not in, I even feel like I don't know what's happening, because it's just such a spectacle and it's so beautifully made. And I wasn't there to see it, that for a minute there, I forget that I've even read the scripts. You know, I don't want to know. I don't want the mystery and the surprises to be taken away. God, no. But, you know, like my husband and my daughter both read the last page of a novel before they start. So it's just a personality thing.
All right. right. So that's a wrap on Still Watching Westworld. We are full-time Still Watching Mrs. America now. Come join us. Talk about the ERA and other protests. If you're in the mood for shows about protests, that is a show you might enjoy. Richard, until then, which is Wednesday, when Still Watching Mrs. America comes out, where can folks find you?
I think I've almost finished my Bin Bonds making machine, kind of like how Charlotte has a basement full of, you know, things creating, hosts. It's more of a single service kind of machine. And I think we're almost there. I've had a lot of kind of failed, attempts, which has actually been kind of horrifying, but, so I'm excited for that. And I'm doing it from home all safely. And I'm tweeting at Rylaws and writing at vf.com. Joanna, where will you be until we meet to talk about Mrs. America?
I'll be at the incinerator destroying your failed versions of Bin Bonds.
They're really scary. I mean, they're really terrifying. They're horrible.
So creepy. They gotta go. So I'll be cleaning that up, that mess up for you. You can find me on vf.com. You can find us talking about the film Amadeus over on Little Gold Men this week. And we'll be back on Wednesday, to talk Mrs. America with Elizabeth Banks.
These violent delights and violent ends.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.